Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Larson, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Francis Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Let's all be seated. Our first case this morning, well, actually, I guess before we started, we welcome our high school students. Probably not going to be as interesting as a trial, but you know, you can always watch Law and Order when you get home. So our first case this morning is 823-1365. I hope I pronounced this correctly. Alessandra Orthy versus Orthy. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent 15 minutes, and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level, and please begin by telling us who you are.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Kuhl, and I represent the appellant, Alessandra Orthy. The trial court in this case erred in finding that it had no jurisdiction or authority to consider spousal maintenance, both because jurisdiction over spousal maintenance was reserved and because the obligation to share bonuses is still ongoing, which gives the court jurisdiction to modify spousal maintenance. Either one of these two reasons is sufficient in itself to give the trial court jurisdiction and would be sufficient in itself for this court to reverse. First, there is no explicit language or magic words that need to be used to reserve jurisdiction over spousal maintenance. The case law,
as I have come to learn to my chagrin.
Yes, we have both come to learn. It does not, it can be done implicitly. And the case law is clear that that is a possibility, and it's binding case law on this court. So the question is whether the language used here is sufficient for an implicit reservation of jurisdiction. And of course, we argue that it is. The key language we're looking at says respondent's spousal maintenance obligation shall be reviewed by March 31st on a de novo basis. As long as moving papers are filed before March 31st, the hearing can take place after. And so on and so forth. But the key is shall be reviewed. It, of course, shall is mandatory. It means that it must be reviewed by the trial court. And of course, if it must be reviewed by the trial court, that means there must be a reservation of jurisdiction to allow the court to do that. It's also significant language because the party's prior stipulations said that it may be submitted to the court if they could not breach an agreement in mediation. So the use of the word shall is important and significant and intentional. Respondent instead focuses on the word preserve. Placeholder motion is all that would be required to preserve de novo review of the spousal maintenance. But preserve modifies de novo review. So it just says if it's not filed by March 31st, the review will not be de novo. It will be subject to the regular modification standard, which of course is very different than the initial determination of spousal maintenance, which is what de novo review indicates. So it's entirely possible to give meaning to all of those words in the stipulation while still finding a reservation of jurisdiction.
What would be the impact of applying de novo review versus normal spousal maintenance in this circumstance? Because I think that you've conceded that it was not filed by the date in the stipulation. So what would be the import, what would be the consequences of failing to file the motion by this date?
Sure. So de novo review means the court is looking at the factors that it considers on an initial determination of spousal maintenance. But when it's a modification of spousal maintenance under the statute, that requires the person moving for modification to show a substantial change of circumstances that makes the existing award unreasonable or unfair. So that's a much different burden than an initial spousal maintenance determination.
Would that be more or less favorable to your client in this circumstance, modification as opposed to initial determination?
I think it would be... Well, it goes both ways because to the extent the regular spousal maintenance payments were through March 31st, and a motion for modification to extend those payments would be, you know, our burden, but the bonus payments are ongoing, so husband has an obligation to make a motion to modify to end the bonus sharing payments. And that would be his burden to show a modification.
Thank you.
But the temporary maintenance ended on March 31, right?
No. The monthly payments or bi-monthly payments were to be through March 31, but there was never an end date listed for the sharing of the bonuses. And so the spousal maintenance as a whole continues, you know, with no end date.
So help me, counsel, because I'm looking at this, I think this is the final stipulation. It uses the word "and removing the component of spousal maintenance." You know, how is that ongoing if the whereas clause talks about removing it?
Because that's not actually what the fifth stipulation did. The fifth stipulation says he doesn't have to share bonuses received between, I think, June and December. And so when the sixth stipulation uses the word removing, it's actually talking about, if you look in the language used, right before the part that you quoted, it says, respondent, that they agreed respondent would continue to pay spousal maintenance in the amount of $5,800 from July 1 through December 31st and removing the component of spousal maintenance relating to respondent's bonus. Well, that's true for the time period of July 1 through December 31st. They removed that component. But if you look at the fifth stipulation, they never said that it was removed forever. And in fact, the sixth stipulation requires him to continue to share information about the bonuses and the kid expenses, which contemplates that that's ongoing.
But wouldn't the next phrase, I'm looking at the sixth stipulation, so talking about removing the component of spousal maintenance, right, that had happened, but further extending the deadline for, it just seems like you've got, well, there's removal and there's further extension. So in the contrast, wouldn't removal mean permanently removed?
I don't think that's the correct way to interpret it. Again, especially when you look at the actual language of the fifth stipulation, which did not do that. And there's case law that says whereas clauses are not part of the controlling contract. And so to the extent the court interprets this whereas clause as inconsistent with what the fifth stipulation actually did and what the operative provisions of the sixth stipulation contemplate, that those operative provisions control. You can't change that through a whereas clause by mischaracterizing what you actually agreed to.
Who has the burden here, you or respondent, to prove that maintenance was the issue of, in your case, permanent maintenance is reserved? Who has the burden under these stipulations? Wouldn't you have the burden?
I mean, I don't know that the case law has specifically articulated that one way or the other. It's just a matter of looking at what the language says, so I don't know that which party has the burden makes much of a difference, frankly.
You know, you do quote Johnson, and at least two of us are familiar with that case. I will say I did specifically put in that case the language due to the unique facts and circumstances of this case. So I'm really not so sure Johnson gets you where you want to be, because that was very unique and the facts are very different from your client's situation. Would that be a fair statement? Since you were also on Johnson, as I recall.
Yes, I recall Johnson.
So we all know how unique the facts and circumstances were in that case.
I would argue that the facts of this circumstances, this case, are unique as well. I mean,
okay, in what way?
Well, I mean,
the language in the stipulation, or I think I was referring to, perhaps Judge Jessen can correct me, she always does, of the appellant in that case. I mean,
correct. The appellant in that case had some medical issues, and the
she
court
had more than some medical issues. Right. She was going to be on the street.
Well, and the court recognized that would have been a case for permanent spousal maintenance. And the same is true here. These parties were married. Well, she doesn't have medical issues, but these parties were married for 22 years. She did not work outside the home for 15 years. The parties acknowledged that, you know, she was going to be in need of spousal maintenance, and it would have probably been a good situation for permanent spousal maintenance from the beginning. So when you look at, you know, does it make sense to assume that the parties would have thought that this was an obligation that would end completely with no reservation of jurisdiction, I think you get to the same spot where it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Fair enough. I mean, I think the flip, well, and I don't know, I wasn't the district court, I wasn't in any of these mediations, but it seemed like, you know, and you can all correct me, it seemed like, you know, these stipulations, your client was getting temporary maintenance, and these stipulations seemed to be, continued to be extended because of COVID and because, you know, everything shut down, including her education. And, you know, that was kind of the purpose. And now, you know, thank God she's gotten her education. She seems to have a good job. So outside of the length of the marriage, you know, I'm not so sure this, I can see why the district court made its decision, at least on the equitable portions of your argument. They didn't seem to be as compelling as they were in Johnson v. Johnson. So why am I wrong?
Well, I think this case is somewhat like the Carlson case in that, yes, they set it temporarily because she was starting a new career, but it's not that they thought she was going to need no maintenance at the end of her career. Or at the end of her education and the start of her career. It's that they didn't know what the amount would be. So, you know, even when she had temporarily secured a position that was about $150,000 a year, he still agreed he needed to pay spousal maintenance. So I get the trial court's offhanded comment that, you know, she's making $125,000 a year now. Some people might think that seems like a decent amount of money, but when you're looking at the standard of living of the parties during the marriage, it might not be sufficient for her to live, you know.
Right, but I mean, I appreciate that, and I have Carlson in front of me, you know, and again, every case is slightly different, but in Carlson, you know, I'm focusing on Judge Wright's thoughtful opinion, you know, where she refers to the stipulated judgment states, the parties have provided for the future support of wife through payment of maintenance, but rather than specify at the outset the duration or amount, the judgment sets only husband's obligations for the immediate future and provides procedure for setting those long-term obligations. And in there, it seemed to be everyone was uncertain because of this two-year non-compete agreement, which is not here.
Well, and here everyone was uncertain because we weren't sure exactly how much money she was going to be making once she actually completes her education and goes to school. But there's a line in Carlson that says the question is not, was never whether she would be awarded spousal maintenance permanently, but how much. And that line, I think, is what is relevant here. These parties recognized that she was going to need spousal maintenance for not just until she completes her schooling, but for a long period of time.
And remind me again, counsel, how long had she been receiving the temporary maintenance? For how many years was that? Like through March 31, I can't remember, 22, 23.
I think it's March 31, 2023.
And how long had the temporary maintenance been going on for that?
Well, I believe the judgment decree was in 2019.
Okay, so 4 years-ish.
Yeah.
Okay.
After a 22-year marriage. Yeah. Correct.
Believe me, I did circle that in the opinion. I got it. I'm sure we all got it.
So. Just clarifying.
I got it.
Excellent. I do want to talk just briefly about the other way that the court could rule is through the ongoing bonus sharing. I think we talked a little bit about that. There never was an end date listed for that. Regardless of how it's characterized in the sixth and final stipulation. And so when the last stipulation says spousal maintenance shall be reviewed, it doesn't say shall end if it's not reviewed. So there's nothing really that ever says that stopped permanently. And so again, in order to stop that obligation, husband would have to bring a motion to modify spousal maintenance to remove that component. And I do think the part of the sixth stipulation that talks about requiring him to share evidence of the expenses for the children through the children's graduation from college suggests that this isn't just a, you know, they were expecting maintenance to continue at least through that time period, which is several years into the future. And so that, again, suggests that everybody really knew here that this was going to be ongoing.
Does the record indicate how old the children are now?
The children's birth dates are in the record, I believe, in the judgment and decree.
So how old are they? Ballpark. I assume they're like closer to 18 than 2.
Yes, they're in college.
Okay.
But it's obviously parties don't have an obligation to provide for children who are in college, but these parties agreed that while the children were in college, he would pay certain expenses.
And sometimes
for
parents
them.
Agree that the obligation goes beyond college into early adulthood.
Shockingly, some parents care about their children beyond the age 18. Yes.
Sometimes too much. Sometimes too much.
Yes. So unless the court has further questions.
I don't think we do.
Thank you.
Thank you. You will have rebuttal, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. Josh Brecken, BREKKEN, appearing on behalf of the respondent, Christopher Scott Orthy. May it please the court. Your Honors, I think in all cases you have to start with one thing, and what's that one thing? The rule. We all have to know what the rule is before we can apply the law. And here, there's a very clear rule on the issue and that the facts apply to, and that is when there is a temporary spousal maintenance order and all the payments are made and that temporary time is defined and it ends, and there's no motion or reservation of jurisdiction, then the court's authority and jurisdiction also ends with it. And that's because there is no longer any maintenance to exercise authority over. It is done and has ceased. And that's exactly what happened here. There was temporary maintenance. Any suggestion that the parties intended for maintenance to be permanent, I think, is frankly silly. They used the word temporary 31 times, again and again and again, in all of their stipulations. In all of their stipulations too, and in the language that they put in their decree, they stated that Ms. Orthy would become self-supporting. So in direct contradiction of counsel's arguments that, oh, we didn't know what she was going to make. Well, that's true because nobody has a crystal ball in terms of the exact amount of money that Ms. Orthy might make. But they did put in express language that said they expected her to become fully self-supporting after completion of her degree and a time frame to enter into the program and workforce.
So where is this language? Where should
it's,
I look?
It's in the decree, Your Honor.
Okay, fair enough.
And it's been, definitely within the briefs. It expressly states that. The payments were made by Mr. Orthy over the temporary periods and all the extensions of the deadlines. That time period ended and no motion was filed. It's as straightforward as that, Your Honors. The court has no authority or jurisdiction over something that no longer exists. And all of the facts dictate the same result in upholding the district court's decision as a matter of law. In response to the argument that there was a reservation of jurisdiction, I'll acknowledge that there is case law and language that says it can be necessarily inferred or that it could be implied. I do think that appellant has now acknowledged that there is not express reservation of jurisdiction of this issue in argument today.
Well, isn't appellant arguing that the word shall means that it was reserved? I mean, that's how I understand appellant.
Well, that's the argument, I think. But I guess what I'm saying is that the words reservation of wife's spousal maintenance award is reserved is
but
not.
But our case law doesn't require it to say
correct.
That. I mean, it can be something more vague, like the district court shall review this, period, end of sentence. Do you think that would have been sufficient?
No, I don't. If it just says it shall review it, and again, I think in the circumstances that we're contemplating in the question, it also can only be implied. If it isn't expressly stated, as I put forth, which, as you pointed out, Your Honor, that it doesn't have to. It can be implied or necessarily inferred. But then again, you rely on the particular facts and circumstances of every case. And as the discussion relating to Johnson pointed out, these are only in the most, you know, extreme of circumstances that are not present here at all.
But here we're talking about a stipulation between two pretty sophisticated parties. I think that's pretty clear from the language in the stipulations. And so why, just taking the dates out of it, why wouldn't it have been sufficient to say to reserve jurisdiction if the parties had said the district court after March 31st, the district court shall review this issue de novo, period, end of sentence? Why wouldn't that have been sufficient? Taking out the by clause and what the by clause means, why wouldn't that have been a sufficient sort of explicit reservation of the district court's jurisdiction?
Well, I think you'd have to, again, look to the facts and circumstances of that particular case. With just that fact alone, just saying it shall review the issue, I don't think that is sufficient to reserve the issue of jurisdiction and authority. And again, if we take out the by clause, but shall review de novo, you know, are they preserving the de novo standard of review, or are they preserving jurisdiction? And here you don't have to say that jurisdiction is going to be ending at the time period either. That's not what the case law requires either. It just requires that it's expressed that there is an end date of maintenance, and here it cannot be disputed, and it isn't disputed, that there was an end date expressed and there was no motion filed after that. So if the court just says it shall review this now, and I want to point out too, these are two sophisticated parties, and that's one of the circumstances that shows that this case doesn't warrant any equitable relief or other relief at all. They had representation the entire time. It was a stipulation of theirs. It wasn't something the court, you know, thrust upon them, as is in other cases. And also, in terms of just, you know, the sophistication and the language, sorry, I lost my train of thought there, Your Honor, just in terms of it is in there, and they know what they were doing the whole time. You know, so I just don't see why you can ignore the other language, you know, that's in the decree and say, oh, nope, this is it. You know, there's this conflation of the standard of review with the issue of jurisdiction. And that's not proper, because the issue of jurisdiction is connected to the maintenance payment period. Now, if there was a reservation of jurisdiction expressed, again, it's not here. They're saying that the other words somehow established that reservation. And that's, of course, where we differ. It wasn't expressed. This is the point that I was going to make, Judge Larson. They did reserve jurisdiction over other issues in their divorce decree. They said the court retains jurisdiction over X issue, retirement. They had some quadros they had to do. They had some property transfers they had to do. They specifically knew how to retain jurisdiction expressly. Why would they go forth and imply it, you know, through a whole bunch of other things when they already knew how to expressly reserve it? And I know, granted, they don't have to, but they did. And I think that's one fact that points to the result that there wasn't in a reservation of jurisdiction.
And that, the language you're talking about, I should also look in the judgment and decree.
Correct, Your Honor. Yep. Go ahead. I would say,
in terms of the language that you're relying on, that they contemplated that she would be fully self-supporting, mm-hmm. You're relying on the language that she had the capacity to become self-supporting after completion of her PA program and a period of reentry into the workforce. That's the language that you're relying on.
Correct, Your Honors. And I don't have it right in here in front of me. Yes, it says has the capacity. Yes, you're correct. Has the capacity to become self-supporting after completion of her physician's assistant program and a period of reentry into the workforce. So, yeah, that's in the decree. And again, one of the things they specifically contemplated, and again, of course, I think the language being they have the capacity to, we don't know exactly what's going to happen 4 years from now, but there's expectations that they've certainly put into this decree. And none of the expectations reflect that the parties thought that maintenance would continue forever or permanently. They fully expected it to have an end date after she completed her program and had a time of reentry into the workforce.
You know, I guess I'm just trying to figure out how this does fit into the, you know, the Carlson case, where the parties had the issue was really how much spousal maintenance there was going to be, not whether or not there would be spousal maintenance. And so I would guess that that would be the language you would point us to distinguish this case from Carlson, to say this wasn't a whether she was going to have spousal maintenance or not. Is there any other language that you would point to distinguish this case from Carlson?
Well, the 31 times that they referenced a temporary order, the specific
you
ended.
Can have temporary and then seek permanent, right? I mean, you're not disputing that she could have sought permanent spousal maintenance if after reentry to the workforce, she realized that her degree was not going to even out and she wasn't going to be self-supporting, that she could have asked for permanent, even though these preceding ones had been temporary. That's not your argument.
No, and she could have, but she didn't. And that's the point, is that she didn't ask for it. And there was a deadline, a strict set forth expressed deadline for that to happen that coincided with the end of the maintenance payments. In terms of just Carlson, Your Honor, again, there was a lot of references and language in that case, and we can, I guess, put aside the fact that it's an unreported case, but there was a lot of references in language that husband was going to pay, I think it was tuition payments and other payments beyond the time frame that the maintenance period ended. He did, in fact, make those payments. He also continued to make payments even after the spousal maintenance period had ended. So none of that exists here. There isn't anything comparative or analogous to the case.
Unless one, we would agree with appellant's approach to the bonus situation. And could you just address for me why there was, the requirement to share information about the bonuses if the obligation to share those bonuses was removed? I mean, should that, the fact that there was a information sharing lead us to think that maybe perhaps implicitly that could be revisited, if that could be revisited, like, that, you know, then put was somehow jurisdiction implicitly preserved?
No, the jurisdiction is not implicit in that at all. The concept of sharing income and expenses and information, again, just happens between parties and did happen between parties. In this case, Your Honor, as noted, they have adult children now and have helped them financially, even though they're legally is not an obligation. And it just, it does not pertain to jurisdiction. And I don't think you can lead to that conclusion, because to do so would be to ignore completely everything else that is in writing, that is expressed. You can't say we removed this issue and say it's not removed or it's ongoing. Those two things are too conflicting to be reconciled.
To the argument about it being in a whereas clause?
It doesn't matter, Your Honor. The point is that the parties removed it and they signed a document with very clear language regardless. And I don't know the case, but that says whereas clauses, don't have meaning. I don't think that's what the holding is, certainly, of that case, in the sense that they don't have meaning. And I would need to know the particulars of that case that counsel references. But whereas clauses certainly can be read, and they are still part of the contract. And when you make reference to something,
at the very least, they provide some context, whether they're buying.
Exactly. So, yeah, you can't just, again, ignore the whereas clauses, which I think you have to just completely ignore those. And you have to completely ignore the deadlines that were put in time and time again. And you have to completely ignore the preservation requirement language. So, I don't think you can get to that result under the facts of this case and the language that the parties use.
I just have one question going back to the shall language. So if we disagreed with you that you could have an express reservation, if you had said, this is purely hypothetical.
Yep.
End date is this date. The district court shall review spousal maintenance thereafter, period. Like if that was sufficient for an explicit reservation, just hypothetically,
yeah.
You agree that the clause that you have in your, in this stipulation, do you agree with the interpretation of the by language that has to do with the standard of review, or would you interpret that by language differently to make it different than the circumstance of the district court shall thereafter review spousal maintenance?
I think it would be the standard of review. I think the by language would relate back to that.
You agree that if the shall was enough, that the by language would go to the standard.
And if we're talking about it from the standpoint of the court put that in there in its own order, and there were other circumstances, again, I don't know that I can agree that just the phrase, and are we removing everything else, Your Honor, like everything outside of that in terms of the language the parties had here?
Yeah.
It was just, here's the temporary maintenance. The court shall review this thereafter.
Yeah, something
and again,
broad
saying
like that.
After, I think, is a key thing because it's contemplating, again, a period after the end. Here, pardon me, there is no such language. There is no after. It says the court shall review by under de novo. Again, I think the emphasis there was just preserving the standard of review as opposed to a statutory standard of review and modification. And to answer your question for counsel before, I don't think it does make a difference. It really doesn't matter what the standard of review is because the same rule applies.
Yeah, and I just so, wanted to make sure I understood your argument with respect to both clauses within that. So,
right.
So thank you.
And I think that's key. If you contemplate spousal maintenance continuing after a particular date, well, that could lead to a particular result as it did in the Johnson case, as it did in the Carlson case. Here, there isn't any such contemplation. So in closing, Your Honors, I think there's examples here, the bonus issue, the other language of the appellant's position just showing that they are ignoring the language. They are ignoring the basic rule that applies to this case. And they have to support their position, but that's untenable. And the facts and the law of this case dictate a result that affirms the lower court's decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Counsel for the appellant, you'll have the last word, please.
Thank you. First, it's not just appellant's suggestion that the parties intended for the possibility of permanent spousal maintenance here. The trial court, in its order finding no jurisdiction over a wife's motion, actually says the parties had contemplated the possibility of permanent spousal maintenance for years. And so that's not something that I'm sort of just making up here, that the trial court recognized that they had contemplated that. As to,
and I assume that you would interpret the phrase that counsel was talking about with respect to self-supporting, you would then say that has the capacity did not mean that the parties agreed that there would not be permanent spousal maintenance.
Yes. So has the capacity suggests potentially she could reach that capacity, but potentially not. And so that leaves open the possibility that she may not become self-supporting, and when there's uncertainty, permanent spousal maintenance is typically more appropriate. I would also say that that language states has the capacity after a period of education and re-entry into the workforce, and that period of re-entry into the workforce had not yet occurred at the time of the last stipulation because she had completed her schooling, but she had not found a permanent position yet. And so even if that the court reads that section that respondent quoted differently, I think you could still find that they contemplated that maintenance would at least continue beyond this period of time that they had talked about in the stipulation.
You know, if we look at the district court's order, the district court seemed to place great emphasis on the first stipulation, which specifically had language that said wife's award for spousal maintenance is preserved. So, I mean, I think if I could understand the district court, it was sort of like, and again, going back to the sophisticated parties with their sophisticated attorneys, you know, if you wanted that, you could have put that in the sixth stipulation, but you didn't. And yes, believe me, I am more than aware that, you know, you don't have to have any particular magic language and that it can be implied or inferred and all facts are different. But what about that? I mean, that seems to take away from your argument that, oh, no, it was just the de novo jurisdiction that they were reserving, not or that would be waived if they didn't file by the, you know, the magic date. So what about that?
I think you answered your own question in that yes, they could have done it differently, but the question before the court is not really about whether
they were so sophisticated
that everyone wanted the nuances and no one wanted to come out and say it.
In hindsight, I'm sure we all wish that we would have done things differently, well, but the question is whether it's sufficient.
I understand. I mean, you're not going to get a stipulation for the sixth stipulation if it said, oh, and by the way, either, you know, jurisdiction reserved or jurisdiction not reserved. So by God, we're not going to put, you know, one side wasn't going to agree to one of the others. But now it's sort of like, you know, we have to, you know, now you're throwing it on us. And I get it that that's our job, but it's sort of like, you know, it seems like you were all too sophisticated for your own good.
I don't know that that's the case. I mean, I disagree with the argument by respondent that this is necessarily implicit. I think shall be reviewed is pretty explicit. And so I think, you know.
But how do you respond to the argument that in other places it was more explicit than shall be reviewed, right? I mean, there are other places in the stipulations. We reserve, the district court reserves jurisdiction over this issue. And so what are, I guess, what's your best case for sort of that, you know, the using different language in the stipulation doesn't mean different things in this context where you're talking about, you know, people who are represented by law firms, and there's sort of a sophistication behind the drafting of these, of this particular stipulation.
I don't know if I can point to a particular case. They're all so fact dependent, but I would just say the question is not whether it could have been done differently. It's whether what was done is sufficient. And for those reasons, we'd ask the court to reverse and remand for the trial court to consider wife's motion on the merits.
Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted. We will issue our decision within 90 days.